very nice village, but it's a bit scattered. It's a bit scattered. Awfully scattered. The scattered community.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome. This was an unplanned stream. I was actually wanting to do one of those Twitter Q&A things, but old Elon Musk has not enabled desktop support for Spaces yet. I mean, it's only 2024. So instead, I thought I'd share some of the things I've been thinking about when it comes to the now pretty much fully fledged triple alliance or new axis of evil or tripartite axis and the various other names that the West have wanted to give to this alliance, the Russia-China-Iran alliance, okay, which has emerged over the past few years. Just before I get going, I'm going to remind everybody, do buy my courses, especially the Trivium at the Academic Agency. And for old time's sake, why don't we whirl an ad? Shall we do a Trivium ad? Let's do Foundations of Economics for old time's sake.
Are you sick of hearing about Marx and Keynes? Do you want to know why neoclassical economics is so flawed? Have you ever wondered how to work out the marginal productivity of a burger bun? Do you want to level up your econ knowledge? Buy it now. £350. Foundations of Economics. Foundations of Economics.
I'm here.
Foundations of Economics. Get it now.
All right. So one of the reasons I wanted to do this stream is because since this Houthi business has taken place this past week, I've seen an awfully large uptick in people, you know, supposedly quote unquote based people who in a situation like this basically just like default to establishment talking points, end up supporting the actions of the American government, and they give assessments of what is happening that I believe have no accord with reality whatsoever. And I actually think that this is a, you know, the other day, Semyagog asked me a question. You know, he said, you know, elite theory applies to everywhere, but it doesn't apply to America, right? It was a good question, because I do actually think elite theory applies to America as it applies to everywhere else. And anyone who studied the American regime and its actions over the past couple of years, especially as regards the Ukraine war, will know that there's a kind of malaise at the top in Washington. Starts with Joe Biden, it filters down to everybody else, right? I'm not talking about the fact that he's old and decrepit, although that certainly doesn't help. What I'm talking about is a kind of culture, a kind of bubble that exists in Washington, wherein nobody is allowed to tell the truth about what is happening, right? There is this kind of feeling with Joe Biden that he's not aware that it's 2024, not 1995, right? I mean, he's made many, many statements like, oh, yes, we're America, man, the greatest nation in the world. We can deal with this. You know, we can do anything. As if America is sitting on top and is basically like infallible and can't take an L and all the rest of him. And we know from people like John Mearsheimer, from people like Douglas McGregor, from various former CIA operatives, that this culture doesn't just exist among the political class. It pervades across the entire American military and its intelligence services. There is a culture of careerism and a culture wherein ideology trumps realism. Okay, ideology trumps realism. So what is the narrative? What is the narrative that the Americans in what, like when I say the Americans, I mean the regime in Washington from which men like Mearsheimer and McGregor and so on are excluded. So they don't allow those voices to kind of try to speak sense into them. What is the narrative they wish to perpetuate? Well, they want to say something like, America always wins. America is the best. America is the greatest. And all of our enemies basically are paper tigers when push comes to shove. And in that narrative, America only takes W's and never takes L's. And the rest of the world exists to take said L's. Okay. I remember reading a story. I was looking one night at war games, American military war games. Okay. Ostensibly, what I was looking for was the story that they keep on running these war games where the Royal Marines defeat, I'm trying to remember who it was now. Anyway, the Royal Marines have like 100 Royal Marines defeated 1,000 American commandos or something like that. I actually discovered that they run this game like every single year, and the Royal Marines have like an almost perfect record. Like they always win. So it wasn't that much of a story. But when I was looking for that, I couldn't help but notice the number of stories that were coming up of people who were in the military saying that various generals had shut down war games when they were running war game scenarios with China, and it looked like America was losing, and they shut it down because they didn't want to know, because they're looking for the correct answer ideologically, the one that fits the narrative, not the one that's actually going to happen in the real world. Okay. Now you can see why this lack of realism at the top is a problem. Okay. But coming back to Semiagog's, Semiagog's questions, does elite theory count for America? Well, I think this thinking then filters down to the population, and it filters down even to people ostensibly in the right wing. Okay. And how does that sort of narrative get to the sorts of people who are going to be watching this show? And it gets to them because they're watching people like Peter Zahan would be the obvious one, who has been predicting like Russian and Chinese collapse for the past 30 years. You always get the same. Whenever I see the same talking points repeated over and over and over again, I know they've been fed. They've been fed by somebody, right? Another way I know is that when those talking points coming from Americans basically echo the talking points that I see every day on Twitter from the Tory boys, because in the world of the Tory boys, again, the actions of the British government are always correct. The British only ever take W's. They never take losses. Everything we've done for the past 30 years is justified. The neocon agenda is right. All of our enemies are just kind of, they're just kind of like third world savages who can be stomped on as if they're carrying like watermelons and spears, right? This is the way these people talk. When it comes to this current conflict, not only do I think that Washington need to update their firmware a little bit to adjust to the actual realities on the ground, I think that the average kind of person and the average people in my audience and so on need to actually face the reality of what has actually happened and who America is actually up against, what their actual strength is, as opposed to running this kind of cartoon story where America is always the strongest and the greatest and all their enemies ultimately are paper tigers, which is what they want you to believe. And I just don't see the point in maintaining something that is actually a fiction or a lie. Even if half of this stuff that I'm going to outline in this stream is true, then at the very least, you have to adjust the way you think about these things. You know, I'm still seeing people every single day on Twitter talking as if, a war with Iran would just be like a rerun of the war with Iraq in 2003. you've got to be, you know, you're out of your tree if you think that a war with Iran is going to be, America just marches straight into Tehran, flattens a couple of buildings, and the government is going to topple like what happened to Saddam Hussein. You are not assessing the situation correctly. I also think that another variant of this has crept in into kind of more dissident or white nationalist spaces. The so-called dissident right. I am on record saying that I no longer believe the dissident right exists at all, for reasons that we can outline on a different stream. In fact, Dickie Spencer had a Twitter space last night where he kind of outlined why the dissident right no longer exists. And he's pretty much spot on in that analysis. But, it's basically been co-opted by the mainstream, contained. Its usable talking points have been mainstreamed, and its unusable ones have been kind of, this current situation is a good example. So in some parts of the quote unquote right, it's based to be racist. Okay. So over this current conflict with Israel, there's a dichotomy that has emerged where, if you think that the forces that are opposing America and Israel have a chance of winning, then you're a quote-unquote third worldist, or you're supporting Team Brown. Because really what this is about is Team White, that's America and Israel and Britain, versus Team Brown, right? Which is this alliance that we're going to be talking, right? I mean, to me, this is a clumsy, fudged, and downright embarrassing attempt by Zionists to co-opt the energy of the populist right. Unfortunately, as embarrassing and as transparent, as pathetic as it is, it does in fact work. It does work, and has worked as a strategy, to the point where I would say that there's a greater moral unity between the elites and the people on this issue than there has been on any issue since pretty much 9/11. There are people who resist, Devin Stack, like Black Pilled, Nick Fuentes is still out there doing his thing with the kind of people around him. There are people who speak out, but I would say that they are actually in the minority, and that the majority of commentators in the space are actually choosing to lean into this kind of, I'm on Team White against quote-unquote Team Brown, okay? This is the new thing. And if you analyze that, basically what it is an updated version of the counter-jihad playbook, okay? Only counter-jihad was, look at the appalling human rights record, and isn't it terrible how Islam treats women? Well, they're not stupid. They know that narrative is not going to run with the online right as it exists today. But if we can make it a bit of allowable racism, let's run with that. So if we can make it Team White versus Team Brown, maybe I'll go with that. Okay. And, basically that's successful. I'm not like, people are, at the end of the day, human beings, most people are sheep-like pigs at the trough, being fed narratives by their masters, which they willingly gobble up in exchange for breads and circuses. This is the eternal truth of human beings. Okay. All people, everywhere, always. Okay. It is to be expected. It cannot be condemned. It just is what it is. Okay. But here on this channel, I don't like to, sugarcoat things, and I don't like to tell you lies just to make you feel good. Okay, I want to give a realistic assessment of what is actually happening. Okay, and so the real question in this stream is, how big is this alliance between the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians, and how seriously should people in the West take it as a kind of challenge to American hegemony? And then I suppose a third question would be, if you're broadly speaking against the regime, as almost everybody watching the show, I assume, would be, how should you position yourself vis-a-vis this conflict, right? Because granted, the Russians, the Chinese, and the Iranians are never going to be your friends in a civilizational sense, okay? But that does not mean that tactically or strategically you could not, you know, their wins against the regime could actually be beneficial in various different ways from our point of view, okay? But that is an open question which we'll come back to. So the first thing I want to you see, and you see, even as I'm talking, I can see people in the chat say, just kind of shrugging it off. We don't need to take this very seriously. It's not like it's nothing at the end of the day. Nothing to worry about. You know, this is it doesn't matter at the end of the day. And I just don't think that is true. I think that people need to readjust. You know, it is not 2003, 2004 anymore. Things have changed a lot in 20 years. And we'll be having a look at all of that in the coming hour or so, okay? Before we get going, though, I want to give a bit of historical context, because one of the interesting things of this Triple Alliance, you know, recently I've bought all of these books, lovely books, because I want to do this civilization series where basically in the space of 40 or 50 shows, I want to give a kind of broad history of all of the major civilizations that have been past and present, okay? Starting with the Mesopotamians and moving right the way through to some of the more modern powers. I'm probably going to stop in 2014, something like that. 1914, just before World War One. I won't do anything beyond there. So it won't go into the Soviet Union or America. It will probably stop with the British Empire. But it's kind of an interesting, like, grand project I have. So I've been thinking a lot about the enduring civilizations, okay? And, you know, looking at my bookshelf here, two of the, you know, let's say there have been seven major civilizations in any given period. Well, two of them, Persia and China, are basically ever-present, okay? They are a perpetual present on the map, you know, a kind of grand old powers, okay? Now, granted, modern-day Iran is under an Islamic theocracy, and modern-day China is under the Communist Party, okay? But underneath all of the ideology and all of the bullshit, they're still basically Iran and China, okay, which have been there since the year dot, i.e. for all of history, okay, which means that we can actually see how these powers have interacted, you know, in the long durée over a very long period of time. Now, the other power, Russia, has only really existed, you know, I would describe Russia as a, broadly speaking, a modern power, you know, from the Imperial Russians onwards, really, from Peter the Great onwards, you know, maybe a little bit before that. But broadly speaking, I would start the Russian history proper in about 1600, okay? Yes, there was the Rus and all these kind of other people coming from the steppes, you know, before then. But broadly speaking, in geopolitical terms, they're only on the map in, you know, the middle modern, late modern period, okay? But anyway, let's have a little look at how these powers have interacted historically. And then we will come forward to today just to see how big a deal it is the fact that these three powers in particular have decided to make this alliance, okay? So let us have a look then at... and I one of the things I'll say going forward is that a lot of people in Britain and America have a reflexive patriotism whereby they always want to say they're the best and that they can't take any L's and that everything that their army and governments do is great and everything that these other powers do is rubbish, ultimately, okay? Now, psychologically, I've never understood that point of view, okay? It's just like, I mean, I'm someone who grew up I was into like football management, you know, I was into like football tactics and sport management, right? In sport, I just can't imagine a football manager who just went into every single game saying, yeah, we're the best team. We're never going to lose. We don't have anything to worry about. All their players are rubbish. You know, that's just not how, that is not how like it works at the level of football. Now we're looking at international relations and geopolitics. And at this level, of course, it matters what the strengths and weaknesses of your opponents are. And there's a tendency, I would say, of people to only want to look at the weaknesses of their opponents and just completely ignore the strengths. Now, for me, Ukraine should be the big lesson on the follies of doing that. Okay. All of the press told us that Ukraine was going to win, that Putin was going to fall, that Putin only has weeks left, that he had cancer, that Russia's rubbish, Russia can't win a war. All of this crap we were told. And yet, who in the long run, the people on the other side basically were proven correct. You know, Ukraine hasn't got a hope in hell of winning that war and never did. And yet, that is not the view that the media gave us. And so when I see people in my chat coming up with all of these lines or repeating like Peter Zahan talking points, you might as well be sitting on CNN because that's what CNN want you to believe. But of course, CNN lie. CNN lie about everything. CNN cannot tell you the difference between a man and a woman. And you're expecting them to tell you the truth about geopolitical realities. They lie about everything else. So, you know, what I'm saying is in this sphere, ideology and blinkeredness and cope is ruling the day at the moment. And I just don't understand why there are so many people in our spheres who basically follow our governments in adopting these same copes. So anyway, let us carry on. And have a look at some of these maps I've prepared. So this is a map of the kind of world or the known world, you could call it, in 100 AD. Okay, so the Roman Empire is still there. You can see the Parthian Empire, that's the Persians, the second Persian Empire, you could call it, right? There's the original one, Cyrus the Great. Then there's the Sassanids a little bit later on. In the middle, you have this Parthian Empire, okay? You've got the Kush, which is there. And then there's the Han Chinese Empire, okay? And even back then, there was a Silk Road that ran, roughly speaking, from there in the middle of China, all the way across the Kush, all across northern Iran, and into, that's Turkey. Okay. And just to have a look at how these powers sit, okay, you've got China in the southeast of Asia. Obviously, Russia's not there yet as Russia. And then you've got Iran or Persia as this middle power here. This is the Middle East, right? And historically, it's been one of the dominant players in this part of the map. Okay. And usually, as you can see here, there's the Roman Empire. Okay. And yeah, there were lots of Roman Persian wars. But generally speaking, there's some sort of entente situation or some sort of permanent barrier that stops the Persians coming west. Okay. There's some dominant power that sits in there. Okay. It's the Roman Empire here. Later, it'll be the Byzantines. Later on again, it will be the Ottoman Empire. And today it's Turkey sitting there, okay? So there is a natural limit to Persia going into Europe, okay? And as far as I know, Persia has never got, like, further than Turkey. It's had lots of wars here, but it's never got over here, okay? And this is important to realize because, essentially, if you look at Iran, it's a regional power, and its region, the one like it, that it knows like the back of its hand, is here. Okay, At its greatest extent, it may come up into the Caucasus. It may take, you know, it can go west a bit. It can go, you know, sometimes the Persian Empire is extended all the way through India. Okay. But it never really goes beyond there. Okay. That is the kind of historical limits of Greater Persia. Okay. Now, one of the really interesting things about, I'll just make this map bigger so you can all see what I'm talking about. Okay. One of the interesting things, if you have a look at the history of Sino-Persian relations, that is China as a power and Persia or Iran as a power all the way through history, considering both of them have been there since at least 500 BC or something like that. Okay. From 500 BC to now, China and Iran have never had a war. Never once have they had a war. And I was having a look. I was like, surely that can't be right. They've never had a war. And even under the Mongols, when, you know, after Genghis Khan came, the Mongol Empire split up into these khanates, right? You know, there was Kublai Khan, and then there was various different other khanates. Iran became, it was called the Ilkhanate, and China became the Yuan, Y-U-A-N, the Yuan, right? But even during that period, where various Mongol clans then started warring with each other, right, after the the big Mongol Empire broke down, even in that period, the Ilkhanate and the Yuan were actually at peace. So the history of Iran and China is actually really boring and can just be symbolized by two words, the Silk Road. They've just traded. They've traded forever. That's been their entire history. I'll give you some goods, you give me some goods. I'll give you some goods, you give me some goods. That's it. Never once had a war, never once done anything else. And basically that historic relationship has persisted till now through all the different changes, all the different governments, all the different kings and emperors and communist this and Islamic that. That's been the history of China and Persia. Now, we'll get on to, they have recently signed a massive trade deal, okay? The trade deal that China and Iran have signed is a 25-year deal whereby China invests $400 billion into Iranian infrastructure, specifically oil infrastructure, as well as a couple of Belt and Road things, okay? Now, that number, 400 billion, is pretty big and is actually technically bigger than the entire GDP of Iran. I mean, $400 billion is a big amount. It's bigger than the GDP of Iran and bigger than the GDP of most countries in the world, okay? This is a massive trade deal that they signed in 2021, and we'll come back to that soon. Because if you're looking at the size of the bet that China has made, clearly they're in this, they're thinking in a 25-year time span, this alliance is going to endure and persist, right? They're making a bet, the Chinese, okay? And that's not a small bet. It's an absolutely massive one, $400 billion, okay? Now, we'll come back to that, and we'll come back to China later on. Because when we start looking at the, so we're going to zoom forward now to 1650 on the map, and the history of Persian-Russian relations is not as rosy as the Chinese-Iranian ones, okay? So in 1650, you can see Britain already had an empire, a commonwealth, and there was a company called the Muscovy Company. Now, from 1453, Mehmed II had shut down the Silk Road in here somewhere. So the historic trade that went that way through Turkey and down the Silk Road was shut off by the Ottomans, okay? And also, there was no Suez Canal, so you couldn't go that way. So the English needed a way basically to trade with the Persians and various other people. And this Muscovy company, one of the original joint stock companies, they actually did this. They made a deal with Tsarist Russia and they sailed that way. They went up over Denmark. Any Danes there will know that there was a bit of argy-bargy around these shipping lanes that the English were using at this time. But anyway, they went through there, sailed through there. There's a port there in Russia. They'd offload goods. They'd go down and make this long journey through Russia into northern Iran, and goods would go then. You know, they trade with the Persians there, and some of those goods then would end up all the way in China. That's how the trade route worked at that time. Okay. So for a period, let's say 1500 to about 1650, the Russians and the Persians had pretty good relations, in alliance with the English, who also had, you know, they had quite kind of nice relations here during this time. However, that was going to change, I think, in 1651. And the history of the next 200 years of Russia and Persia is pretty bad. There's tons and tons of Persian-Russian wars, okay? When it was the Safavids, the Persians were stronger at this time. And they actually, they nicked a number of Caucasus. They nicked a few lands. You'd have to look into specifically which ones, but I know the Persians had a number of victories early on. But over time, basically the strength of the Russian Empire ended up being too much for the Persians, especially when they came under the rule of the Qajars, for my money, one of the worst ruling dynasties of any country of all time. I mean, the 19th century, you know, if China had a century of humiliation in the 19th century, that would also be true of the Iranians, who had an absolutely abysmal 19th century. During this period, the Russians basically had, they'd beaten them in a number of wars. I think the last one was in 1820 or something. And the Russians then started trying to interfere in Persian affairs. And they were also how can I put this? They weren't very nice to the Persians. Persians historically are proud people, very proud of their history and their long kind of civilization. But during this period, the Russians were like, you know, they saw them as inferior Orientals. I've read some very strange things about this where, because the Russians are kind of half Asiatic, but during this period, they wanted to be seen as European and white. When it came to their relations with Persia, they wanted to feel superior to someone, right? And because they'd recently won this war, they started behaving in this way. And anyway, they tried to set up some banks and things like that. And the Qajars were, I think, weak kings, really. And the nation, Persia, really had a very bad period here. On top of that, the British at this time, of course, controlled large chunks of India. You can see all of the British bits of India there. So obviously they had a permanent base kind of nearby. And obviously they could sail straight in there. And during this time, basically, there was a couple of Anglo-Persian wars, but basically the Qajars, to cut a long story short, sold out the entire infrastructure of Iran or of Persia to the British at this time. They sold them everything. Tobacco, fucking monopoly contracts on crops, and then it all culminated in the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, whereby they were like, okay, in exchange for building the infrastructure, we'll take like 6% of oil and you keep all the rest. I mean, they're like kind of historically bad deals done by the Qajars. I mean, they literally hoard out and sold out the country, okay? I really hate this. There's this one Qajar king who he's the one who's famous for having the harem of women with mustaches who all look like bloody like Downs people, kids. You know, have you seen that court with all, you know, one of them, they've all got mustaches and they kind of fat and ugly. That king, not only did he sell out the country pretty much, but also he was a massive kind of European fanboy and simp. He wrote this, it's a very interesting travelogue, actually. It's a book that he wrote where he went to Paris and he went to London and he was like, oh my God, Europe's so amazing. Europe is the best place ever. These people are almost like gods. You know, I want Persia to be like this. So he kind of like had a hard on for European modernity. You could put it that way. Industrial Europe. He saw it. He saw the steam engines and so on, and he thought it was magic, right? And basically sold out the nation. He's like, listen, I want anything it takes. You British, come here, build all the great things, because we want to be like you. Okay. Now, you can kind of understand that thinking to an extent, but you know, in the long durée, like this is the country that produced Cyrus the Great is behaving like this now. So this is like particularly embarrassing, I think. Period in Persian history. Okay. And basically this more or less persists. Qajars are overthrown naturally. And there's a guy called Reza Shah who comes along. He was friendlier with the mid-century Germans and more of a nationalist. And more, he was the one who changed the name of the country from Persia to Iran. My dad quite likes Reza Shah for various different reasons. I've never quite understood that because, among other things, my dad's from a group called the Bakhtiari, and Reza Shah like almost like wiped those guys out in various different ways and banned them from their traditional dress, and you know he was almost like a kind of Stalinist figure in a way, like a kind of modernizer. But anyway, he was friendly with the mid-century Germans. Like some of you will know that Adolf Hitler made a rule in 1936 that the Iranians are the true Aryans, and gave them special dispensation to become like German citizens. Okay. But partly that was a geopolitical thing because Reza Shah was his ally and they wanted to, like, he made this big deal of changing the name of the country to Iran, which means land of the Aryans. So you can see how there was a natural alliance there. Less well known is the invasion of the Allied forces into Iran in 1941. I mentioned that briefly during Britain's blunder, where they basically overthrew Reza Shah and replaced him with the final Shah, the last Shah, Pahlavi, who I am sure you're all familiar with. If you know one Shah, you know that one. Okay. The last Shah. Now, some people have a fondness for him. It's hard to be fond of someone who ended like literally a 3,000 year unbroken chain of monarchy. It's ended by him. So, you know, I don't have, such a rosy assessment. If you're interested in some of his blunders, there's a video in my archives called the Shah's White Revolution. He tried that, like this kind of modernizing. He tried to massively westernize Iran in the 60s, basically like break the old aristocracy and the old landowners. He basically like banned peasants. Like, you're not allowed to be a peasant anymore, which sounds bizarre. But so, yeah, I mean, there were lots of things that he did that I think sowed the seeds of the massive resentment that there was in the country against him, which was basically a conservative revolution in many respects. Okay. But anyway, the upshot of all of that during the Cold War period is this ridiculous alliance called the Baghdad Pact, right? If you're wondering if the Ottomans and the Persians, the Turks and the Persians were ever friends, well, during the Cold War, they made this thing called CENTO, right? That is Turkey, Iraq, Iran, and Pakistan. Four nations there. Two of them historical rivals, of course, the Turks and the Persians, united against communism in 1974. Okay? Now, the absurdity of this alliance surely is self-evident, okay? And I would say that this may be one of the worst alliances ever in history, in so much as what a farce it is. Within, well, 6 years of this map, Iran and Iraq would be at war. Iran will have flipped and, you know, kicked out the great Satan. Within 20 years of this, Osama bin Laden would be training in the mountains of Pakistan. And fast forward to 2024, and now you've got Erdogan in Turkey as well. I mean, it is really like the difference between this map and the state of play today. So that is how much has changed in the space of 50 years is quite extraordinary. I think you'd agree, right? I think you'd agree. Remember, Orwell, we've always been at war with so-and-so. We've always been friends with so-and-so. Well, you know. So this context, I hope you can see the context, right? Because back in this time, if you go back and have a look at Israel, for example, it was having constant war with Arab nations, war with Jordan, or war with Egypt, or whoever, you know, Six-Day War, all of this sort of stuff. And so these nations, which are circled, were the Islamic powers friendly to the West, and the ones outside the circle were the ones hostile to the West, and Russia aligned. Okay. But of course, Russia was successfully able to flip many of them. And, you know, in the 80s, there's a bit of back and forth, but we don't need to go into the ins and outs. Anyway, by 1979, of course, you have the revolution, and that brings us up to today. I'll just mention very quickly as well that one of the permanent powers that the Iranians always have to be aware of is the Ottomans, all the way back to the, look, there's the Turks, there's the Persians. Ever since the Turks appeared on the map as a power, they've had to be aware of them on their west. And even though they're getting friendlier at the moment, I would say that there's a reason why this alliance here was never going to work out in the long run. Okay. I don't know of any period where the Turks and the Persians have been friends, like, you know, for long. They've had like periods of peace, but historically, generally, I mean, it's like France and Britain or something. They're always at war, you know, on and off. Friends, now we're friends, now we're not again. Now we're friends, now we're not again. And if you have a look at the history of the Ottomans and the Persians, you can see the Ottomans take it sometimes, the Persians take it sometimes. Although, as I mentioned on Twitter, taking a loss to the Qajars has got to be one of the most embarrassing moments in Turkey's history, because the Qajars, as I mentioned, probably the worst ruling dynasty of all time, and the Turks still lost to them. So, let us now fast forward to the modern era. Okay. Now, I have to mention, I've got two videos that we're going to watch. Okay. Now, I may pause them to, comment or interject, but I've selected that they're both 10 minutes each, but I think they supply a lot of interesting information. Okay. Now, the first one, I have Iranian petty. I should say that I don't really care that the Qajars beat the Ottomans. I just find it, if anything, that is a symptom of Ottoman weakness. You know, the sick man of Europe and all of that. They had an abysmal 19th century as well. So and I'm sure Apostolic Majesty has got about 50 videos on the Ottoman Empire that you can read, that you can watch in your own time. But it is like, you know, the Qajar ship losses to everyone. It's like getting beaten by West Brom or something. I don't know. Anyway. Now, I'm going to play a video from an Indian channel, okay? And it's important that it's India, I think, called, I'm trying to remember what this channel is called. It's one of these big channels that's got like 10 million, something like, it's called WION, and the show is called Gravitas, okay? Now, I will warn you that this woman is pretty Indian, okay? And she's brown, okay? But I think it's really interesting to listen to the tone that she takes and how she passes the issue. Because a lot of people looking on see all of the Zionist Indian call center shills on Twitter. And they assume that, oh, basically India's a friend. Basically, India loves the West. Basically, India is part of us. And that, you know, as long as India is a part of BRICS, it's nothing because the Indians love us. That is actually not true. I don't want to get off on too much of a digression on India, but there was a, what was his name? Nehru was one of the Indian leaders in the past who had a doctrine whereby India would have a studied neutrality between America and Russia. Okay. And this is significant also because let me just go back to this map a second before we get to, I hope this historical context is going to add something, but if we go back to the 1974 map, that was the world as it was in 1974. Okay. Now, everybody today uses the term third world, right, to refer to anywhere pretty much that's not the West, okay? But that is actually not what third world meant, okay? There was the first world, which was basically anywhere that is America aligned, okay? That's all of Europe, all of Western Europe, Canada, Japan, pile of South American dictators, right? And this Cento thing here, that was actually included in the quote unquote first world. Okay. If you use the term as it was intended, it was part of the first world, as was South Africa, by the way, considered part of the quote unquote first world. Okay. The second world was anywhere under Soviet influence, okay? Anywhere that basically took its orders from Moscow, that was the second world. And the reason that this is important is that this Nehru doctrine, right, this third way, this studied independence between, Moscow and Washington, that was called the third world. So India basically was seen as the leader of the quote-unquote third world, okay? Now people talk about third worldism, right? That is bandied about a lot, the term third worldism. But actually what third worldism is, if you look into it, is something closer to this idea of Nehru's and Indian strategy, basically, which is we're going to do what's best for us, and we're not going to commit either to the West and to America fully, and we're never going to commit fully to the Russians. We'll play them off, and we'll basically try to be quids in whatever happens and do what's best. The most important thing for India, given their history, is that they remain sovereign, that they don't allow any foreign nation to interfere with their internal politics, that they don't allow any foreign nation to dictate what they should be doing at any one point. So India is committed basically to independence, and third worldism in that sense was that basic strategy. It has come to mean something else now, right? Let me see if I can find that map. I'll just get this map. It's come to mean something else now, which is basically this kind of project to try to bring up all of those nations that were considered third world, which basically was India and all of these nations in Africa here, Middle Africa. Let me see if I can find the map of global poverty that I pulled up the other day. Hold on a minute. Because it illustrates the point well. Hold on a minute. Because it's, you know, third worldism is the idea that we're going to do what's necessary now to try to bring up those nations, try to help those nations become, quote unquote, developed. Okay. This is slightly different from this other phrase that you hear, which is the global south, which I'll talk about in a second. Let me see if I can find this map in a minute. This map here. Okay, here we go. This map here shows, this is the number of people. This, now, considering this map was in 2011, right? This was 2011, this map. So, you know, we're 10 years on again from this, okay? If you have a look, the white countries are countries with a headcount, that is, the percentage of the population is less than 1% who live on $1.90 a day. You can see, basically, it's most of Europe, right? As you'd expect, it's Canada, it's Australia, it's Japan. But look at that, it's also China. It's also Russia. It's also Turkey. It's also Iran, funny enough. It's also basically all of Eastern Europe. So if you have a look at absolute poverty in that way, those countries that people just assume like, oh, they all just live in grinding, they just live in hellholes, these people. We're going to bomb them into civilization. It's not actually the case. Now, if you have a look at the dark red, that is 70 to 80% of the population lives on $1.90 a day. You have a look, it's very heavily red, sub-Saharan Africa. Okay? And also, you have a look, India is much deeper because poverty is still a problem in India. Okay? So when people talk about the third world, really, and third worldism, really it's these countries you should bear in mind. Okay? This kind of I'm just trying to give a kind of clearer picture of who is on the map and what these different agendas are. Now, there's another thing that people talk about, which is the global south. And I'll just bring that up a second, because that's more relevant to what we're talking about. Let's see if we can find a bigger map of the global south. Okay, this is another way of looking at things now. And I think this is becoming more and more prevalent, okay? So this is this idea that you have the global north and the global south, okay? Now you can see that The global south includes everywhere below Mexico, all of Africa, all of the Middle East, India, etc. It excludes Australia. It excludes Japan. And on this map, it excludes Russia. Okay. But since the Ukraine war, especially, but I would say it started before then. It really started about 2007, 2008. The Russians have increasingly looked to Asia, and the Russians have increasingly become friendly with China, and as we'll explore, and they've become a lot more influential in the Middle East. And basically what Russia have done is they've decided, right, it's not working out. The Europeans hate us. The Europeans don't see us as one of them. We've tried to be nice. We've tried to make it work. We did your Boris Yeltsin bullshit and it fucking sucked. You know, it's not working out. You hate us. You see us as Asiatic hordes anyway. You see us as, you know, you don't respect us. You know, our Russophobia is rampant in the West. Washington hates us for some reason, almost like they've got a kind of blood libel on us, right? Fuck you, basically. We're going to orientate ourselves towards the quote-unquote global South, okay? Now, to come back to this first world, second world, third world thing, okay? Really what's happening is that I think we're going back to a situation where this alliance that we're looking at now, the Russia-Iran-China alliance, are trying to create effectively what was known as the second world before, i.e. a new order, a new kind of, Mia Shimer would call it a bounded order, right? And if you go back to your Cold War map, what they used to do, go back to the Cold War map, what the great game was at this time between America and Moscow was that basically all of the rest of the world, the global South, if you want to put it that way, all of Africa and all of South America was basically a game of flip. Now we're going to flip you blue. Now we're going to flip you red. Now you like, you know, you've all played Tropico, right? You can either side with America or you can side with the USSR. Are we going to flip your African nation blue or are we going to flip it red? You know, now Brazil loves America. Now Brazil loves Russia. Now, you know, well, we've lost Venezuela. It's always been like that in that part of the world. And this is actually, we've already seen bits of that play out. Do you remember when there was the coup in Niger and Wagner were down there? Right? Do you remember all of that? Do you remember Tony Blair Institute being kicked out of like three different African nations? What is Tony Blair doing in Africa? He is basically, this is like Cold War 2.0, what's going on, right? So that is how I would kind of pass some of these different terms. So when people throw out third worldist in that way, I think they should tread with caution as to what exactly they're talking about. Okay. Anyway, let's listen to this Indian woman now and her explanation of what has happened between Russia, Iran, and China over the past few years. I'll interrupt where necessary, but I'll try to let her play for as long as possible.
A new axis of world powers with common grievances and one common enemy. No prizes for guessing which one, the United States of America. A country which has for decades tried to shape our world in its image and established its preeminence. In almost every facet of power, be it military, economy, technology, culture, or morality for that matter. It is America the world looks up to, all thanks to its global influence networks and, of course, the American PR machinery. But what if I tell you that things are changing? That America's global empire is crumbling, the hegemony of Western nations is dying. And a new alliance is looking to replace it, an alliance led by three countries, Russia, China, and Iran. the three most sanctioned countries in the world. They seem to have formed a rather informal alliance of convenience, a loose alliance of sorts which the West is calling a troika of tyranny and a triad of bullies. What have they done to deserve such titles, and can they really reshape the prevailing world order? Or will they instead push the world into further disorder? And above everything else, where does India fit in this new axis? Does it have any reason to worry? We'll find out over the...
I mean, of course, they're Indian, so they're going to care about where India fits in. But her answers to that question are interesting in and of themselves.
Next few minutes. Hello and welcome to Gravitas Plus. My name is Priyanka Sharma. A new global alliance is now in the making, an alliance between China, Iran and Moscow. They're forging their strategic, defense and economic ties. It doesn't take a genius to notice the pattern. Just look at some recent developments. Ever since Russia invaded Ukraine, the three countries have come closer. Yes, China is uncomfortable with the war, but it still provides Russia with a diplomatic umbrella. It is also helping Moscow economically by rejecting the G7's price caps on oil. The same case with Iran. It is still buying Russian oil and sending weapons in return. Yes, for the last 1 year, Tehran has sent countless kamikaze drones. And if reports are to be believed, it might just send ballistic missiles by this October. These deals are being accompanied by state visits. Leaders and officials from all three countries have been frequently flying to each other's capitals. In July last year, the Russian president went to Tehran. He met his counterpart, Ebrahim Raisi, and discussed strengthening bilateral ties. Contrary to expectations, Iran didn't downplay this visit. In fact, it rolled out a red carpet for Vladimir Putin. The Iranian oil minister personally went to greet Putin. And then in November, a group of Russian security officials visited Iran. Their aim was to find ways to counter Western pressure on both countries. Syria is another good example. Another good example of the Iranian and Russian interests coming together. For years now, both sides have been trying to keep Bashar al-Assad in power. Their only aim is to counter American interests in Syria. Just last week, the US shot down Iranian-made spy drones in Syria. And if we speak of Russia, despite being militarily involved in Ukraine, Russia still maintains a military presence in Syria, an indication that it's not leaving the country anytime soon. And if we speak of Russian and Iranian cooperation in Syria...
I should mention, by the way, that this video is quite old. This video was made in February, I think. And since this time, as well as Russia buying Iranian drones and weapons and so on, Iran now have signed a deal for the biggest cache of weapons from Russia for 30 years, I think it is. So that they have massively boosted their kind of military arsenal. How the Russians can afford to give all those weapons, given how much ammunition they've used on the Ukrainians, I don't know. But they have. They did sign that deal, I think, about 5-6 months ago. So
it's a tale that gets murkier the deeper you dig. Russia continues to provide a decisive cover to Syrian and Iranian-backed ground forces in Syria. And then, of course, we have China. Chinese President Xi Jinping and Russia's Putin recently caught up over a phone call. This was around New Year's Eve. The two sides released statements saying the ties are at their historic best. What's more, Putin said he's expecting a state visit from Xi Jinping soon. "We are expecting you, dear friend," was the message from Moscow. We are hardly surprised. The entire world knows about China's bonhomie with Russia, and we'll focus on China's love affair with Iran, an affair getting intense by the day. You see, in 2021, China and Iran signed a 25-year comprehensive strategic partnership deal, a deal that has given China its deepest ever foothold in Iran, with many Iranians even saying that the deal has literally sold Iran to China.
And I'll just mention, by the way, that this is the point of view of my dad and most opponents of the regime, many of whom follow me on Twitter and occasionally counter-signal me when I talk about Iran. Because, I mean, just to be clear, my view is that as bad as the regime is in Iran, thinking civilizationally, they've probably done the right things for Iranian sovereignty to kick the West out, basically. I think, but, you know, if I was the leader of Iran, that's probably what I would have done. Okay. The specifics and the corruption, the Islamic nature of it are all a shame, right? But basically, they're doing what strong historical leaders of Iran should do. Okay. And I think they've played a blinder, as we'll go forward. Now, on the face of it, this particular deal, do you remember I was talking about the Qajars selling out Iran to the British, you know, the Anglo-Persian Oil Company being the most prominent example, but there were many others. There's a massive tobacco firm whose name I forget now. But they were basically like selling monopoly contracts to the British in exchange for like sweet FA, basically. Like, oh, you get 6%, right, of everything we make and you keep the rest. This is how like BP, British Petroleum, was formed, by such a deal, okay? And everybody will know about Mossadegh, who tried to nationalize oil. And now I can see that from the British point of view, because they put up all the capital, they fronted the risk and the investment. So why the hell should the Iranian state have the right to just seize it? Okay, I understand like both sides, but obviously from the Iranian national point of view, it's like, well, this is our oil, and we're getting 6%. That couldn't last forever. It was just a fucking terrible deal signed by the Qajars. And the argument of Mossadegh was, listen, you signed that deal with the Qajars. This is not this government. We'd never have signed to that deal. So why should we honor it? Does that make sense? It'd be like the Chinese government honoring a deal that had been signed like before 1949 or something. Well, why should we do it? Or it would be like, I don't know. I mean, you can pick your own example so that you can see, like, he did have an argument. But now, the regime in Iran has made like a similar deal with China. So how can this work, you know? But if you actually look into the ins and outs of that deal, as far as I can see, the Chinese do not keep the profits stay, the actual infrastructure they're setting up remains Iranian, okay? What the Chinese are getting is extensively discounted oil, right? Let's say the global oil price is, you know, X today. The Chinese are getting it like half or like even less than that, okay? The reason my dad is upset about this is because oil prices are high now, right? They're high. And yet Iran is selling it at like discounted price to China. Okay. But I actually think it's not a bad move in the long run, because it means that you've got China invested for literally $400 billion in your country. So they're going to have your backs, right? They're in now. They've made the bet. They can't go back on this. There's a bit of Belt and Road stuff in there as well, but you know, if I was to look at the old deal that the Qajars made with the British and this deal, I would say this deal is a lot better than that deal, right? You know, they are giving you $400 billion, so they're going to have something in exchange. And cheap oil in the current climate is pretty good for China as well. So anyway, let's carry on.
But the Islamic Republic's leadership doesn't see it that way. Why? Because in return, Iran was made a permanent member of the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a body led by China. It's the largest regional organization in terms of world population, global GDP, and geographic scope. Iran's membership in this body does little for the region it represents, but more for the powers that run it, Russia and China. With Iran on their side, their ambitions of countering the West get greater legitimacy and support. For Iran, this membership helps it battle the economic isolation from the West. So it's a win-win deal of sorts. In December last year, China's...
Yeah, I mean, they can say, well, sanctions? What sanctions? We're now dealing with the number two economic power in the entire world. With what is it, the sixth? You know, Putin is now claiming that Russia is the sixth biggest economy in the world, depending on how you measure it. If you measure it by GDP, it's a lot less. But if you do it by purchasing power parity, Putin is now claiming to be the biggest economy in Europe. And I'm sure the Tory boys would have a problem with that. But if you, you know, at the end of the day, the purchasing power parity is the thing that matters, not the total top line GDP figure, which is meaningless. So, you know, this is a pretty good way for Iran to get out of the economic sanction stranglehold that Washington has had on it since 1979. They've played a blinder here. And, you know, we can say, well, how stupid is the West to push Russia into their arms? Because by trying to do the same thing to Russia and put the economic sanctions on Russia, you've now created this. Nice one. Well done, Boris. Or Biden or whoever else. Brilliant. That's a, they've played a great game, the West, on this. But let's carry on.
Vice Premier Hu Xunhua flew down to Tehran, and more recently, Iran's president visited China, Ebrahim Raisi. He was in Beijing from the 14th of February to the 16th. The Chinese president gave him a red carpet welcome, followed by a guard of honor by the Chinese military. The arrangements were grand, to say the least. They had to be. After all, this was the first state visit by an Iranian leader to China in almost two decades, and Raisi didn't go to Beijing alone. He took along a huge entourage of ministers. The biggest Iranian delegation to Beijing ever. This included six members of Raisi's cabinet. In an editorial about the visit, China's mouthpiece, the Global Times, said that the visit was proof that an anti-Western front is growing. Allow me to quote the most telling excerpt from the report. It said,
Excerpt.
China's deepening cooperation with Iran also has an anti-hegemony and anti-bullying feature. Both China and Iran uphold independent foreign policies, firmly defend the principle of non-interference in internal affairs on international occasions. If anyone feels targeted in this process, then they should first reflect on whether they are too selfish. So how do we perceive such statements and developments? Do they indicate the consolidation of an anti-Western axis? Do they indicate the rise of a new world order? It certainly seems like it, and the American media can't stop talking about it.
At least Biden made his way down the stairs, eh? Note, by the way, that the quotes she was reading out were from China. They were from Xi and his government, right? And so, like, as if signing the massive deal with one of the number one enemies of the West wasn't enough of a sign. He's also backing up, they're also backing it up with rhetoric, because the Chinese are like, you know, they're basically calling time on American hegemony, like, openly at this point. You know, this is where the Peter Zahan copes come in. There'll be somebody in the chat saying, oh, yeah, but China's facing a demographic collapse. Oh, it's a paper tiger and all the rest of the things, while ignoring the massive demographic problems that America itself has and that the rest of the West has. Anyway, let's carry on. Oh, no, but see, the thing is that America will survive because it is allowing tens of millions of Latinos to come in over the southern border. And that rate of immigration will save, that'll be the thing that saves America, you know, because it won't face the demographic cliff edge. That's literally Peter Zahn's argument. Anyway, let's carry on.
For the last 2 months, there have been endless reports of how China, Iran and Moscow had joined hands against the West, how Washington will have to take on all three at the same time. And not just these three. Reports say the triad also has a posse of sorcerer's apprentices. What do I mean by that? Smaller nations that agree with their vision, namely Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cambodia, Myanmar, and the most important of them all, North Korea. A country which of late has been flexing its ballistic muscles way too much. So to put it simply, China, Russia and Iran want to unite all like-minded countries behind them and use them as a solid front to counter Western hegemony. This seems like a page straight from the Western Alliance building playbook. In the days ahead, you can expect the...
I can guarantee you, in the comments, in the chat, I'm not looking because I'm too... You know, when I'm doing a stream on my own, it's quite busy to... It's too much to keep track of everything. I can guarantee you right now, there'll be people in the chat and there'll be people in the comments shrugging this off, saying it's nothing. China's nothing. China's a paper tiger. Russia is nothing. Iran is nothing. They're just saber rattling. This is bullshit. I mean, I just don't understand why people are so ostrich-like when it comes to what is happening. Right? It's not 1995. That little moment when the Berlin Wall had fallen, communism was over, and America very briefly controlled Russia through Boris Yeltsin was like literally like a little slither of time before Putin reasserted control. And in fact, the situation's a lot worse because during the late era of the Soviet Union, China had pivoted to the West. China, you know, remember Nixon and Henry Kissinger? You know, China was very friendly to the West during that period and it actually pivoted away from Russia. Now, Russia and China are historically close. Russia and Iran are historically close. Like that historical context I was giving you was to try to show you that, okay, Iran and China historically have been friends, or Persia and China, whichever way you want to say it. The Russians and the Persians have not historically been friends, right? Even now, when you go to, like, I've only been to Iran a couple of times, back in 2002, 2003. And, you know, my grandfather was a kind of sage-like character who would just occasionally, like, make grand pronouncements in the corner and things like that. But he would always say, like, yeah, Russians can't be trusted. You know, the British are a fox, but the Russians, you know, they use these kind of strange phrases like that. So it is remarkable in a way. You know, like I said, during that 19th century of humiliation, the Russians were bastards to the Iranians and they didn't like them. Like, they don't like the Russians historically. And the memory of that is still there. Like, the distrust of the Russians exists among the population, or at least it did 20 years ago. So to see them shacking up like this, like these are, again, historical rivals, but now they're like best buddies, historic friends, not just Russia and Iran, but Russia and China at the same time, and Iran and China at the same time. I mean, I think it's very significant. And, you know, only really a kind of short-termist, non-civilizational kind of American democratic mindset, kind of hubristic ideological mindset can just shrug that off as nothing. It's not nothing. It's really significant. In world history, it's significant. Let's carry on.
These countries to go all guns blazing on the West. You can expect to see them blaming the West for their ills on global forums and using their vote at the UNSC or the UNGA to thwart the multilateral system. The big question, where will all this leave India?
Right, now I'm going to play this last section because Indians are great mates, our historic friends, rolling out the red carpet for Rishi Sunak to pray with Modi. Do you remember that? Oh, we love Israel. Let's have a look at how the Indians respond to all of this.
India be collateral damage in this game plan? Well, we wouldn't go so far as to say that. You see, India has historic ties with Russia. India and Iran also share a cordial relationship. China is obviously an exception. It never fails to provoke India. Yet, New Delhi and Beijing have managed to not let the tensions flare up dramatically. So should India worry about this alliance? We don't think so. This triad just has one rotten apple as far as India is concerned, China. I don't think the other members of this alliance, both present and future, would square off against India, especially Russia and Iran. One can't imagine these two joining an anti-India alliance. In fact, this alliance isn't even about India.
Doesn't affect us, so we don't give a shit, mate. We don't give a shit. Which is to be expected, because India basically are realist in their foreign policy, and they have always had one goal, which is to remain independent. Independent of the great powers, to stand on their own two feet, to not allow themselves to become a colony again, ever. And it works. I mean, it's been working for them.
It's about the West, its monopoly, its dominance, its brazen lectures, and its selfish wars. My point is simple. Russia, China...
Fuck the West, basically. As long as we're right in India, we don't really care about what happens to them. They can buy our tat in the meantime, you know, and we can meet the Prime Minister and we can be on reasonably friendly terms. But in the long run, fuck them. Remember, in geopolitics, there's never like permanent friends. Ultimately, there's only interests.
China and Iran may have their own ulterior motives. They may have their own differences with the West, but their plan might find takers simply because way too many countries are fed up with the West treating the world like their playground, waging wars at whim, imposing sanctions at whim, and preaching to others at whim.
Tell you now, Joe Biden may well go down as the worst American president ever. He may well go down, because if this alliance really does cement this, it's just the end of American hegemony. And in a moment like this, where it's delicate and everybody's kind of ganging up on America and, you know, people are fed up with the West, rather than use diplomacy, rather than try to drive a wedge between this alliance that's forming, rather than talk to the Russians or talk to the Iranians or talk, like, they've just doubled down, tripled down, quadrupled down. And now it's kicked off in Israel. Again, instead of trying to talk to the various different people, no, we're just going to back Israel 100%, you know. So they've even ended up isolating the Turks and the Arabs, who are their friends in the region. I mean, it is remarkable what a terrible job Joe Biden has done. He is, like, I mean, from a domestic point of view, I would always say that LBJ is the worst president, right? And I know a lot of people don't like Lincoln, and cases can be made for Woodrow Wilson and FDR, okay? But from a foreign policy standpoint, in terms of protecting American interests, I think Biden is easily one of the worst presidents of all time. I mean, in 4 years, the mess that has been created is remarkable. It is kind of mind-blowing how badly they've been fucking up the map from the point of view of American power. It's just amazing. Anyway, let's carry on.
Their superpower status may have crumbled, but their sense of entitlement clearly has not. And this sense of entitlement is exactly what's uniting others against them. Think about it.
All right. So that was the video from India. Now, the next thing I want to look at is now I want to look at, it's just a 10-minute segment from a video made by a channel called Real Life Law. Great channel. It's got like 7-8 million subscribers, so it doesn't need any help from little old me, right? But if you don't know it, you should probably, you know, give them a sub, because they do have good videos, okay? But this pivotal 10-minute segment here shows you the extent to which the Americans have also not only buggered up on the macro level of geopolitics, i.e. in the grand game of alliances and so on, they're just losing people to this new alliance between the Russians, the Chinese, and the Iranians. They've also been losing it on the regional level of the Middle East, okay? Because the actual upshot of the wars in Iraq, the wars in Syria, and Afghanistan, and all of American meddling in the region, really, has actually been to massively increase Iranian power in the region. Now, again, a lot of people like my dad and some of those guys you'll see on Twitter, always argue that the Iranian regime has done a terrible job at managing the country, because, you know, the sanctions have worked to an extent. People feel poorer. You know, it's not without its issues domestically, Iran. When they say the government is unpopular, you know, there are people who really hate them. And there was a guy on Twitter earlier on saying, like, honestly, I'd give my life to see these people gone. So they have, like, the Iranian regime is unpopular with sections of the public, especially, I would say, the middle class, which is where my family is from. Ultimately, the, you know, my dad's an engineer. You know, he was never going to stay. And people like that, you know, they're not going to be happy under a conservative theocratic regime. Okay. But they have always made foreign policy a massive priority. And one of the reasons that they're unpopular with people at home, with some people at home, is because they basically just pour billions upon billions of dollars into essentially what is shadow empire building. Okay. Now, to take the regime out of it a second and the ideology out of it for a moment, it is not, if you get again, look in the very long durée, right? Look at all of history and you consider what Persia has been always historically, it is unsurprising to see Iran exert massive influence in the region, because as per Mearsheimer and friends, all of the historic powers have their spheres of influence, right? They've got their regional spheres of influence and they don't want the Americans there, which is what the revolution was about. And they want to kick America out of all of the Middle East, ultimately. And I would say in the very long run, the Chinese probably don't want the Americans on their front door either. And if you look at Russia and what the Ukraine deal is about, the Russians don't want the Americans on their door either. Right? So they all have this goal in common because they're used to, you know, being the little hegemons in their own regions, their regional hegemons, I guess you'd call it. And this section of this video by Real Life Law shows the extent of the forces Iran have on the map at the moment, which I don't think many people know. Like those people who think that, you know, fighting Iran is just going to be as easy as rolling the tanks into Tehran, or I don't know, we'll do a couple of bomb raids on the oil fields and that'll be it. Okay. They got another thing coming, right? And in fact, earlier on, one of the things I didn't know, because I missed it, 2 days, do you remember when January the 6th happened? How could anybody forget, right? Jan 6th. Well, we were all watching that. If you remember, under Trump, they assassinated Soleimani, the general. Do you remember that? Do you remember Soleimani, the general who was killed by the Americans? He was somewhere in Syria. And the Iranians say, well, you're going to pay for this. Two days after January the 6th, when everybody was focused on that, Iran launched 11 ballistic missiles on an American camp, an American air base, an American base in Syria. And they destroyed it. They said, we're going to drop the bomb here. It's going to happen at this time. And you're not going to do anything about it. They dropped the bomb. It completely destroyed the base. Anyone who was there was killed. And it left a massive crater, a 30-foot crater in the ground. Okay? And the American military said, this is the biggest ballistic missile strike on Americans in history. Now, you didn't hear about that. Partly it was because, obviously, Trump and the insurrection was dominating the news. but also because it was a pretty massive L, right? So the Americans may have got Soleimani, the one general, but the Iranians showed them, oh, we've got massive ballistic missiles now, and we can do this. And here's the thing, you can't do anything about it. They didn't do anything about it. Now, that wouldn't have happened in 2004. I don't care what you say, but it did happen in 2021. So let's have a look now at the forces in the region.
Looming all around Israel, circling like sharks sniffing for blood, are Iran and their allied proxy forces that they call the Axis of Resistance, consisting of the king, Iran itself, their rook, the Houthis in control of northwestern Yemen, their knights, the Shiite militias in Iraq and Syria, their bishop, the Bashar al-Assad regime in Syria, their queen, Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, and their various pawns, the many Palestinian militant groups operating within the Gaza Strip, all of whom cooperate together with Iran in pursuit of a common ultimate objective, the complete annihilation of Israel as a state. Of all the pieces on the
board... Now, I should say a moment, right? All of the leaders in this region pay lip service to this idea that, right, they want to destroy Israel. And occasionally they make kind of rhetorical comments. Even Erdogan in Turkey has joined in the death to Israel chants, right? That is because among the populations, they call it the Arab street in the Arab world, but it's also true in Iran itself as well. All of the people in this region hate Israel, okay? The normal people. And it's politically savvy to lean into that. Because it's a popular cause, right? So why wouldn't you pay that lip service? How serious the death to Israel is as an actual geopolitical or geostrategic goal is not clear to me. I would say that Iran has more important goals. Okay. I mean, generally, it wants the American presence out of this region, okay? But it has other goals too, right? For example, maintaining good relations with China and Russia, which we've seen already, expanding its influence over the Middle East, which we're watching right now, okay? Keeping a wedge between the Israelis and the Arabs, I would say, is another goal, okay? These are all things that Iran seeks to do. And I don't know if, the complete destruction of Israel is a serious, it's less serious, I would say, than those other more achievable aims. Let's just put it that way. And if you look at what they've been doing in terms of those aims, as opposed to, the kind of more sensational destruction of Israel aim, they've actually been playing this game extremely well. I would say that they have comprehensively outplayed the Americans pretty much over a 20-year time stretch, as we'll see.
That are in this axis of resistance. It is Iran's rook, the Houthis, who are the ones that are the most geographically far removed from the current fight going on between Israel and Hamas. Their territory is about 1,600 kilometers away from Israel's and separated by the entirety of Saudi Arabia.
I should mention as well that this video was made back in October or November last year. So obviously the things he's talking about now have come to pass. So he actually accurately predicted what was going to happen. Anyway, let's carry on.
Yeah, and nearly the entire length of the Red Sea. But nonetheless, distance has not dissuaded the Houthis from attempting to join in the fight anyway. And they're already using their geographic advantages to harm Israel in other ways. Armed with advanced long-range cruise missiles, surface-to-air missiles, and suicide drones supplied from the Iranians, the Houthis possess substantially more capable weapons than Hamas does, with the ranges required to attack Israel itself. And so, they've been frequently using them ever since Israel began its invasion of the Gaza Strip to target Israel's southernmost city, Eilat, which is also Israel's only maritime port beyond the Mediterranean that's on the Red Sea. So far, all of the missiles and drones that the Houthis have fired towards Eilat have been either intercepted by American or Israeli warships operating within the Red Sea, intercepted by Israeli or Saudi anti-air defenses, or have crashed off target without causing any casualties. But the Houthis are only likely to continue firing more and more the longer that the war in Gaza continues. While the Houthis are beginning to escalate their side of the war much further in other ways, too. On the 19th of November, a cargo ship called the Galaxy Leader that was traveling through the Red Sea on its way to India was spectacularly hijacked by a group of armed and well-trained Houthi militants, who raided the ship with a helicopter and then brought it, along with the ship's entire crew, back to one of their own controlled ports in Yemen as hostages. This hijacking took place shortly after the Houthi spokesperson declared that their intention going forward will be to target any ship owned or operated by Israeli companies or flying the Israeli flag that they catch traveling in the Red Sea or through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. The Galaxy Leader ship that they hijacked on November 19th wasn't crewed by any Israelis, but apparently did have some ownership ties to an Israeli business tycoon. Going forward, the Houthis are likely to continue targeting Israel's ability to conduct trade with Asia through the Suez Canal by attempting...
I should mention that a couple of days back, obviously, the British and the Americans bombed the Houthis to try to stop the blockade of the Red Sea. The Houthis responded by saying, right, now you've hit us. British and American vessels are now fair game, okay? And also on top of that, we're going to blockade the Suez Canal as well. So basically they responded to bombing by saying, up yours, up yours, up yours. F you, a couple of bombs aren't going to stop us. We've literally been bombed for the past 10 years. 15 bombs have already hit these exact same sites. So what are you going to do about it, arsehole? That's what they said. So the Houthis don't give a shit at all. And it's going to take more than the couple of bomb raids that they did a couple of days back to stop them. It's going to take troops on the ground, ultimately. And as we all know, the Americans just won't commit any troops to the ground anymore for some reason. I don't know why that is. Possibly because they'll get their ass kicked, but we'll see.
Further maritime piracy and hijackings around the narrow Bab el-Mandeb Strait that they control most of the eastern shore of.
And again, people act like these Houthis are just like, oh, a bunch of goat-herders or whatever. Remember, okay, the Houthis are at war in Yemen with a force that is backed by Saudi Arabia, Britain, America, all of the West, okay, who give weapons, just like Ukraine. They've backed them with weapons and modern equipment and all the rest of it. And the Houthis have taken the capital. They control about 80% of the country. They fucking kicked their asses. They've basically been winning the Yemeni civil war. But again, everybody wants to carry on in this idea that America is invincible and America can never lose. And America, I mean, basically, as far as I can see, it's the same result over and over and over again, because they won't actually commit to fighting these wars properly. They'll just do what they do in Ukraine. Or you can have ammo. We'll do a couple of bomb runs. We'll do a few strikes here and there. But ultimately, this doesn't win a war. It doesn't win a war. And then if they do commit to a war, they won't probably, because it's an election year, right? And no president is going to put boots on the ground in an election year, because it's, you know, soon as like five soldiers get killed, it's over for him, right? But let's pretend they do commit to a war against let's say, the Houthis, okay? As soon as a few American soldiers get killed, back at home, there'll be protests and it'll be Vietnam again. It'll be just Vietnam again, or Iraq and Afghanistan again. They were in Afghanistan how long? And now it's in Taliban control. They were in Vietnam for how long? And they lost. So I'm just saying that there's only so many times this can happen. And as we'll see in Iraq and in Syria, they were there for God knows how long. And let's see who actually controls these regions now. Let's carry on.
and by continuing to fire missiles and drones at the southern Israeli port of Eilat. From the Houthis' perspective, the aim of these attacks will be to restrict Israel's maritime trade in the Red Sea and through the Suez Canal as much as possible, and limit Israel's ability to conduct maritime trade to only their west coast on the shores of the Mediterranean. And while Israel hasn't retaliated against the Houthis yet...
Look, even as I'm talking now, even as we're going through this, okay, even as I've told you about the ballistic missiles that were used just a couple of years ago, even as we're going through, okay, the actual economic performance of these countries, there's still somebody in my chat saying, oh, this is an idiotic assessment. The Middle East keeps itself in the Stone Age and all of this. These people aren't living in the Stone Age, mate. You've got to have a more adult perspective on what's actually happening. You can't just say, oh yeah, they're living in the Stone Age. They're not living in the Stone Age. Even Syria, Damascus has been there for 3,000 years, by the way, is not living in the Stone Age. And they've had a civil war. Even there, they're not. Okay, let's carry on.
It might be forced to if the war in Gaza continues dragging on and the Houthi attacks on them continue escalating. Meanwhile, officials in the United States are already mulling about what to do about the fate of the hostages taken by the Houthis, and what to do if Houthi piracy in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden continues further. The prospect of the Houthis running amok with piracy in the region right now is a terrifying prospect for Washington to consider, because it stands to jeopardize their much-lauded India-Middle East-Europe economic corridor, a proposal that was announced by the governments of the United States, India, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and the European Union back in September of 2023 during the G20 summit, a month before Hamas's attack on Israel happened. The plan, as it was originally envisioned, was to construct more shipping and rail networks between the loosely aligned governments of India, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Israel, and the European Union. A goal that would greatly benefit the United States as well, because it would also happen to counter China's Belt and Road Initiative ambitions in the region. And, more importantly, it would directly counter Russia's proposed north-south transport corridor between themselves, Azerbaijan, Iran, and India.
Always comes back to the pipes, doesn't it? Always the pipes.
Washington would rather keep India within their economic orbit than Iran's and Russia's. But with the war erupting between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, the strained relations that it's caused between Israel and the Saudis, Jordanians, and Emiratis, the fear of escalation in the West Bank and elsewhere, and the specter of continued Houthi piracy in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, and continued missile attacks on Israel, the future of the India-Middle East-Europe economic corridor is now uncertain. And in order to defend it, the U.S. Navy will be likely to come down hard on Houthi piracy in the region in the future.
Do you remember what Mia Shimer said over and over and over again? Israel is a liability for American foreign policy. Israel is a liability.
The former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, James Stavridis, even further suggested on the 22nd of November that it be made painfully clear to Iran that if they continue supporting Houthi piracy in the region, American maritime operations could equally threaten Iran's own critical offshore oil and gas platforms that are in the Persian Gulf and their own shipping lanes through the narrow Strait of Hormuz. And hence, why one of the American carrier strike groups has relocated from the eastern Mediterranean near Israel to move immediately adjacent to the Strait of Hormuz, off Iran's southern coast. The Houthis made a move on the board. The United States responded with a move on their own, and more may follow. Moving to the north, there is Iran's bishop, the Bashar al-Assad regime in Syria. The Syrian government is the most militantly opposed to Israel's existence that remains in the Arab world, and they've continually remained officially at war with Israel ever since Israel's declaration of independence back in 1948. Their armies have clashed multiple times all throughout history, and ever since 1967, Israel has occupied the strategic plateau of the Golan Heights, a geographic area of high ground looking directly into the lower elevated areas of northern Israel proper, than most of the world recognizes as Israeli-occupied territory of Syria. Syria has continued to maintain its own claim to the Golan Heights ever since they lost it in 1967. But despite that, and despite their continued official state of war with Israel, the Assad regime in Syria is in no possible place to do anything against Israel right now during the war in Gaza, because of their own continuing brutal civil war. Ever since 2012, when the fires of all-out civil war first erupted in Syria, more than 600,000 people in the country have been killed, while more than 6.5 million more people have fled the country, likely making it the single deadliest war ever fought entirely in the 21st century.
See these guys here? They're the ones who are cutting your hair now. All those barbers are cropping up. They're all these guys. Thanks.
In order to stay in power for all these years, the Assad regime has expended absolutely enormous amounts of both resources and lives. And it still isn't over either. The Assad regime continues to only control about 63% of Syria's internationally recognized territory, with significant other sections under the control of Kurdish militias in the northeast, the Turkish armed forces' occupation of strips in the north, a pocket of Sunni Islamists in the northwest, continued pockets of ISIS forces in the interior, an American occupation in the south, and the Israeli occupation of the Golan Heights. Assad Syria still has a lot on their plate left to deal with, especially as one of their biggest supporters, the Russians, have largely pulled most of their military assets out of the country and threw them into their own ongoing invasion of Ukraine and Europe. The civil war in Syria has largely entered into a stalemate by this point, and has become a fairly low-level conflict that's absent of any heavy fighting. Bashar al-Assad's grip over the territory that he does directly control has remained stable for a few years now, and there are some who've suggested that the Syrian civil war has become a frozen conflict. But if Assad decided a gamble to regain Syria's control over the Golan Heights and attack the Israelis right now, while they're distracted by a war in Gaza, there is the chance he would take that the various rebel forces who are still alive and well in Syria might seize upon their own opportunity and renew their offensives against him while he's distracted by the new war that he just started with Israel. And that has the possibility to completely undo the stable but fragile situation in Syria that he finally achieved after a decade of war and hundreds of thousands of lives and the overwhelming support of his Russian allies.
Come, Mossad, the Assad.
Allies who probably won't come to his help again to the same scale that they did last time because, unlike the last time, they're fighting their own colossal war of conquest in Ukraine and have other priorities to deal with. For those reasons, Bashar al-Assad himself will be very likely to keep the Syrian army from attacking the Israelis directly.
This is where it gets interesting, friends. This is where it gets interesting.
And even if he was thinking about intervening, the Israelis already fired missiles at the onset of the war with Hamas breaking out, then knocked out the country's two most major airports at Damascus and Aleppo anyway, meaning that Syria wouldn't be able to fully utilize their air force to initiate an attack. But nonetheless, Syria continues to be very closely aligned with Iran, and the Assad regime can still be a highly useful piece to the rest of the Axis of Resistance's confrontation with Israel, because they willingly offer up their geography to the safe passage of the Axis's other pieces, such as two of Iran's knights. They're Shiite militias placed within Syria nearby to the Israeli-controlled Golan Heights. There is the militia called the Fatimiyun, made up of around 15,000 Shiite fighters hailing from Afghanistan, while the other militia is called the Zainabiyun and is made up of an additional 5,000 Shiite fighters hailing from Pakistan. Both of these militias were organized, funded, and trained by Iran's own Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or IRGC, to fight against Bashar al-Assad's various enemies during the Syrian civil war. But now that the civil war is largely quieted down and the militias both remain near to Israel's de facto borders, they represent roughly 20,000 battle-experienced and well-armed Iranian-aligned fighters sitting around without much to do, and since they're entirely...
I mean, just hanging out in the mountains looking for a...
composed of Afghans and Pakistanis, Tehran might calculate that they are now an expendable force and could serve as the next logical piece on the board to advance forward into the confrontation with Israel, especially if the situation in the West Bank devolves out of control and forces the Israeli army to redeploy some of their units there. An assault by the Fatimiyun and the Zainabiyun into the Golan Heights would provide the Iranian and the Syrian governments with a certain amount of plausible deniability, and it would force the Israelis to confront a new front line in the northeast, at the same time as the Houthis and Hamas continue their fighting on other fronts. But the ultimate question that has been on everyone's mind ever since Hamas first launched their attack on October 7th is, what will Iran's queen on the board end up doing? Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, immediately across the border from Israel's north. You see, Hezbollah is revolutionary Iran's greatest ever success story. It was painstakingly created by the Ayatollah Khamenei and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps during the 1980s out of Lebanon's own significant Shia Muslim population centers in the south and the east of the country, representing the first other country that Iran successfully exported their Shiite Islamic revolution into. Ever since, Hezbollah has been dedicated to driving out all American and European influence in Lebanon, defending Lebanon's Shia Muslim community, spreading Iran's Islamic revolution elsewhere in the world, and assisting Iran with destroying the State of Israel from existence. Since its founding, Hezbollah has grown into what is almost certainly the most influential and well-armed non-state actor anywhere in the world today, and is probably more influential and well-armed than many actual countries are. Their leader, Hassan Nasrallah, boasted in 2021 that the organization had 100,000 fighters at their disposal, while Western estimates believe they have at least 60,000, which is still roughly as large as the entire standing army of Lebanon itself, the country where they are based. And moreover, Hezbollah's fighters are probably better trained, more experienced, better funded, and better equipped than the Lebanese army is as well, which likely means that Hezbollah is more powerful than the Lebanese state itself is. As of 2018, the United States has estimated that the Iranians fund Hezbollah to the tune of $700 million per year, which shields Hezbollah from the financial...
See again, there'll be people thinking, yeah, but if it came to it, the Americans could sort these guys out. They could just bomb them back. They could just bomb these guys back to the Stone Age, man. It's not as easy as that. These guys have already beaten the Israelis once, back in 2006, 2007. I just don't think that. See, the trouble is because of the way that these guys fight and of the way they're set up. This kind of bombing, this like, oh, we're going to do bomb strikes, we're going to do strikes, it never actually solves the problem. You know, they'll just be back again, like in a week or something. There is no way to deal with any of these forces unless they're going to commit troops on the ground. And they're just not going to do it, are they? For the same reason that they're not going to fight the Houthis on the ground, they're never going to commit troops to the ground to fight Hezbollah. And if they did commit troops to the ground to fight the Houthis and Hezbollah, automatically then we're into a hot war scenario with actual Iran. Because as you've heard, they basically control Hezbollah. It's not going to happen. The Americans, for whatever reason, fear this fight. You know, you'll hear all the rah-rah from Lindsey Graham. It's not actually going to happen. I also think the Iranians don't want it to happen as well, which I'll get to in a moment. But the nothing ever happens, boys, ultimately, I think, will win out on this particular conflict. But let's get to the end of this, and then I'll say some more things.
Woes of Lebanon and the weak Lebanese domestic currency. This funding provided by Iran places Hezbollah about on a par with the military budget of Venezuela, an entire country with nearly 29 million people. This funding and continuous military training from Iran has enabled Hezbollah to resemble something more akin to an actual professional army than a mere militia. They are believed to possess a vast arsenal of around 150,000 rockets and missiles, many of which are precision-guided ballistic missiles that can strike anywhere in Israel. They possess advanced anti-air and anti-ship missile defense systems. They have advanced anti-tank weapons. They possess numerous artillery pieces. They control a fleet of aerial drones. They have a capable cyber warfare unit. And, according to U.S. intelligence, they might even possess chemical and biological weapons as well.
Wouldn't rest on U.S. intelligence on that front too much.
Hezbollah is a vastly more intimidating threat to Israel than Hamas is, and it represents Iran's most high-value piece on the board to confront Israel with. Ever since the war between Israel and Hamas began, Hezbollah has declared its solidarity for Hamas, and the two sides have been engaged in skirmishes and light attacks nearly every single day across Israel's northern border.
So that was the only bit I wanted to share, really, to understand that. I mean, that didn't get into the size of the Iranian military, their capacity, the Revolutionary Guard, and all the rest of it. Those are just the proxy forces in the region. So, you know, if you go back to the days of Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi and all those kind of, and back when Assad wasn't messed with, none of that stuff existed in the region. All of that has kind of developed over time, right? Over time, due to the opportunities that have been created by the instability caused in the region, to the point where I sometimes see right wingers claim that Obama and Biden are secretly like Iranian agents. As one guy earlier was saying, oh yeah, John Kerry is an Iranian agent. You know, I don't think that's true. I just think that I just think that the Americans are so bad at this now that they end up basically gifting things to their enemies, because they seem to have lost the ability to think properly strategically when it comes to things like this. I can't really see any other way of looking at it. Last time the Middle East was in focus as much as it is today was back in 2003, 2004, when the Iraq War was going on. And back then, you know, people would say, well, the axis of evil is North Korea, it's Iran, it's Iraq. And, you know, after Iraq, there's going to be a war on Iran. The moment for that, I think, has come, been, and gone. You know, there was a moment where they could have done it. I honestly think the Iranians are much too strong. Like, I would say they're maybe twice, three times as strong as they were 20 years ago, bolstered by the Russians and the Chinese and all of the things that we've discussed on this stream. And if you want my assessment, I don't think that there's going to be a war. I don't think that they're, you know, that they'll continue bombing the Houthis once in a while, as long as they keep up these blockades. What Israel wants to do is to sucker America into committing to a war against Iran, because for the reasons outlined by that video that we just watched, Iran is a major headache for the Israelis. Okay. And I watch this channel called Caroline Glick, and she's always going on about the need to deal with Iran. Obviously, Israel can't deal with Iran. The Americans are the only force, really, who can deal, quote unquote, deal with Iran. Okay. But I think the moment has come, been, and gone for that. And given the strength of this alliance that we've looked at, I think the wiser heads in the Pentagon, especially, aren't going to want to commit the American military, especially in the shape it's in at the moment, under-recruited. You know, they've given tons of ammunitions to Ukraine. They're stretched helping the Israelis. They're stretched at the minute. You know, in the middle of all of this, they're now going to want to commit to fighting this war with not just with Iran, all of its proxy forces, all of its allies. It's just not going to happen. And at the same time, despite what you'll hear from Lindsey Graham and so on, I don't think the Iranians want to escalate either, because this situation as it stands right now, which is essentially the Israelis killing the Palestinians at a basically genocidal rate, which is incensing the Muslim world, massively plays to its advantage. Okay. So I think the Iranians are just happy to just do nothing, essentially, just to chill out and, collect the receipts. The best thing that could happen from the Israeli point of view would be to end the end the war as soon as possible, because the longer it goes on, the more it plays into Iran's hands. Because the Arabs, let's not forget, the Yemen civil war is a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Right? Then, again, the Arabs and the Iranians are natural rivals in this region. But the situation in Gaza has drove a wedge between Israel and Saudi Arabia. It's drove a wedge between Israel and the entire Arab world. It has decimated the Abraham Accords. It's driven a wedge between Israel and Turkey. It is literally normalized relations between the Arabs and the Iranians and the Turks and the Iranians. Again, historical rivals. Now, that won't last in the long run, I would say. They will revert, the Arabs and the Turks, to being more friendly to the West. But so long as this situation persists, it will not. So I would say that the smart thing to do would be to end the conflict as soon as possible, which is what this trial the South Africans have brought is designed to try to do, basically, to try to end the conflict. It's not going to say, oh, well, Israel's guilty of genocide. But what it might do is to say, you have to end the conflict, right? And stop being so mad for a bit. Because ultimately, I think that's what the Americans want as well. Because basically nobody wants World War III, apart from the Israelis. The Israelis want to draw the West into this, into open conflict with Iran. That's what the Israelis want. But I would say be careful what you wish for, because when push comes to shove, I am not confident in the ability of the collective West, as it's known, to win such a war against the combined forces it's up against there. It's not going to be as easy as all of that. Remember, Israel's only like 10 million people or something? It's not like a huge nation. I think they'll find another way, ultimately. And maybe Trump will be the way out of it. Maybe the coming of Trump and the end of Biden will be the way that America gets out of this absolute hole that it's in at the moment. I think the Israelis, if you listen to Caroline Glick and so on, they think that Trump will actually be a boon for them because he's more anti-Iranian than the Biden regime. I'm not sure if Trump is who they think he is. Ultimately, they think they control Trump and that Trump would start a war for them. I don't know about that. I don't know if Trump would start a war for them. But let's see what happens. Maybe this will age like fine wine. Maybe it will age like milk. I expect a huge amounts of cope in the comments. I have not been reading the chat. I assume that at least 2 in 3 of them are NAFO bots, Mossad agents, and various other sniveling regime weasels and Tory boys. My view is, if you take a realistic view of what's going on, people need to recalibrate. People need to kind of at least think more seriously than talking in terms of these platitudes of China's a paper tiger, or, you know, these are just kind of sand people who live in the Stone Age and all of this sort of stuff. I mean, this is not serious analysis. So hopefully you've learnt a little bit from this video. Let me know. I'm sure there'll be tons and tons and tons of counter signaling when it comes to this topic. That's because ultimately, when push comes to shove, people are really invested in wanting to feel that their governments are powerful and things like this. I just think it's all cope, personally. The NREAP has sent a super chat saying, did you ever watch Rob Newman's History of Oil from 2006? It's on YouTube. I did. I remember that came out. And I remember at the time thinking, I wish Rob Newman would go back to doing comedy. But actually, he was probably onto something. Sam153 says, for the beautiful maps. Well, thank you very much, Sam153. It means so much. WC Schmuck has just given 5 cents. He says, a buddy of mine. Oh, no, it's $5. I forgot the way it comes through weirdly now. I said, a buddy of mine was a conservative Republican, became a GOP staffer in DC, and immediately became a neocon 1 year later and is super pro-war now. Unsurprising. And that's it for Super Chats. What I'll say is, very quickly, before I wrap this up, I've got my Adam Curtis mega project starting tomorrow night, on Cigar Stream. The first one is An Ocean Apart. I'll be watching the first two episodes of Oceans Apart later on. But before I get out of here, I'll take a couple of questions. Let's say I'll take three questions from the Peanut Gallery. So I'll have a look at the chat now. It's just whizzing past because I haven't had it on. I'll take three questions from the Peanut Gallery and then we'll wrap this up. Let's have a look. Julia Smith just got here. Well, you should rewind and watch it from the start. How long does the gay have left? I would say, Bar Steward. I think that there's moral unity in the West between elites and the people, even when it comes to a topic like this, because I see those attitudes echoed a lot, the Tory boy attitudes, basically echoed much more than the sort of stuff I've talked about on this stream. And when push comes to shove, there, yes, the elites need to make a few adjustments on woke and a few other things, you know, stop pissing off their populations as much as they are. But ultimately, I think that when push comes to shove, there's moral unity in the West. And as long as that's the case, there'll be a diminishing power on the world stage. But in terms of domestically, I don't think it's going to collapse anytime soon. I hope I'm proven wrong, but I don't think so. Next question. How long does Israel have left is the real question. Well, Marbley, I think as long as America is there, Israel will still exist. You know, even if the gay diminishes, it's not, you know, the American power is not going to just go away overnight. I do think I stand by my original assessment that when all is said and done, Netanyahu will be removed and Israel will be forced to stop being the Schmittian exception. I think that the real meaning of this trial at The Hague that's going on will be to put an end to crazy religious ethno-nationalist Zionism, which is basically just an embarrassment to the ruling class. It's too far away. Can't have Israelis LARPing as Nazis in 2024. But who knows? Who knows? Because so far, they've had everything their own way. They've had everything their own way in America so far. They've been putting the woke away, getting rid of Claudine Gay and all of that, showing their muscle, you know. So it hasn't happened yet, but I expect it to happen. And it might not. And if it doesn't happen, then it's possible that we'll see change sooner rather than later, because I don't think the populations at large are going to accept indefinite support for crazy genocidal Israel. I just don't think it's possible in the long run. But I could be wrong. I could be wrong. You know, maybe they just love it, in which case the regime will last forever. We'll see. And I'll have a look at one last question. Would Israel be better off distancing itself from USA now? Well, the Reverend, I mentioned Carolyn Glick. Now, she is a little bit of a, she's a very hardcore Israeli shill. And I think she's an American who's a settler, an American settler who lives in Israel. She's extremely hardcore, right? She's watched by Mossad, who used to come in the, he was the one who kept on sending me links to say, oh, watch this one, watch that one. But she had a guest on recently called David Goldman, who wrote an excellent article called In the Shadow of American Decline or something like that, where Carolyn Glick and David Goldman were basically saying, like, yeah, America is basically buggered. America is useless. America is run by idiots. America is in decline. This is obvious. What are we going to do? And Carolyn Glick's view, and it has been for a long time, is that Israel needs to be more independent. It needs to stand on its own two feet. It needs to stop being so reliant on America. It needs to find a way of being friendlier with China and Russia. and not basically be, you know, so, how can I say, like, they have an ambition to not have to just be kind of bound by American morality and projects, put it that way, okay? So let's pretend that this new kind of rival world order by the Russians, the Chinese, and the Iranians comes into being. If you think the Israelis, won't, like the Indians, won't stab America in the back in an instant, you've got another thing coming. Because in their foreign policy, well, I say in there, they have people who still think in a realist way in Israel, okay? Now you could argue that what Netanyahu's doing is not very real, right? In another way, you could justify it, as Yarvin did, okay? But Israel are not, and the Israelis are not, ideologically committed to America. They'll say fuck America in a heartbeat, which makes it even more baffling how cucked and pathetic and kind of supine the Western leaders are towards Israel. It really is, like, it turns my stomach to see how pathetic the Americans are when it comes to this issue. Because those conversations happen in broad daylight. The Israelis don't give a shit about you. They wouldn't spit on you. And yet, we see all of this. So, yeah, it is remarkable, really. It is remarkable. Anyway, hopefully this was illuminating. And to be honest, I respect the Israeli position a lot more than the American one, right? From their own point of view, right? Obviously, I am never going to be a hardcore Zionist for reasons I hope are obvious, okay? But from their own point of view, I respect them a lot more. I much more respect a hardcore Jewish Zionist than, you know, these kind of American Christian Zio. I mean, I don't understand that at all. I don't understand the Tory boy at all. But I understand them, and I kind of respect their mindset much more. So, you know, they're going to want to do what's best for their people, as every people should. Okay. Whether what's doing best for their people is, you know, wiping out the Palestinians remains to be seen. Okay. History will judge ultimately, right? Maybe it will be the right thing. Who knows? But I have a feeling that in the end, that they will be brought to heel. But anyway. Glow in the Dark says, with a super chat, I wonder if all of this green energy cope is a way for the West to try to move away from the Middle East oil. I've often thought that, Glow in the Dark. I've often thought that the aim to stop being so reliant on oil could be part of it. But then I also look at the fact that America has a lot of oil itself. Now, I'm not an oil expert, right? And I understand there are different, like, types of oil, right? There's crude oil and there's this oil and that oil. So I don't know if America has all the different types of oil you need, right? But my understanding is that America's sitting pretty when it comes to oil. So it makes even less sense from that point of view. I also don't understand, like, if you have a look into what is required to make green energy, a lot of it is reliant on stuff that's made in China. So China basically is quids in either way. They benefit from that, and of course, the Russians up until recently would benefit from green energy as well because they are the major gas providers in the world. So I don't really understand that. Also, up until recently, they had the Saudis in their pockets as well. So it's hard to fathom what the green stuff is about in a cynical way. I think a lot of them are true believers when it comes to that. I really do think they believe climate change, that the whole narrative around it. That makes sense more of their actions than assuming they're in bad faith, right? But there's an awful lot of grift around it. I also remember reading a paper some years back that a lot of the climate change activism was a Russian psyop. Now, again, I don't know if this was Alex Jones tier stuff or not, but apparently it helps the Russians for people to be more green because they end up relying on stuff that Russia can provide more. So, yeah, I don't know at the end of the day. Anyway, somebody can pull that out. That wouldn't be hard to find. I can't remember where that study was from. To me, it sounds like the sort of thing that would be produced by like the American conservatard sphere, but I could be wrong. I could be wrong on that. All right. Let us get out of here. I'll be back tomorrow night for Cigar Stream. If you want to learn more about politics and so on, I do have a course. It's not on geopolitics. It's just on good old-fashioned politics. Populist Illusion is the textbook for this course. And that is Foundations of Politics.
Foundations of Politics. Only £350. Buy it now. See the world as it is and not how it ought to be. History is the graveyard of aristocracy. Who says organization? Says oligarchy. Who decides? Who interprets? The extremes of individualism and socialism meet. That was their predestined course. Foundations of Politics. Only £350. Buy it now.
All right, thanks everyone. Now get out. Get out.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.